It opens with the line, "It's worse, much worse than you think." And that might be the most cheery thing you'll read in David Wallace Wells' new book, The Uninhabitable Earth, about the fast-approaching, full-on effects of global warming. One review is titled, "The End is Near." David's op-ed in the New York Times was titled, "It's Time to Panic." Remember the Kyoto Protocol back in 1997? Well, a 2-degree Celsius temperature increase was pronounced the upper limit for global warming. It was declared the threshold of catastrophe. Participants said, "We will not cross that line." Well, in the 20 years since, we've produced more emissions than the 20 years before. So, like some crazed auctioneer, we now shout, 3 degrees, 3 degrees, and no more. But what if we can't stop global warming at 3? Because if we can't, we're cooked. David Wallace Wells joins us from New York. David, welcome. Even though you've caused many a nightmare, this is a tough read.
Well, yeah, just trying to spread the news that the scientists have been doing for so long.
Trying to spread that news. Look, you, though, have only been working on this for 3 years, and you were not an environmentalist. In fact, you're very candid, not an animal or nature lover. I mean, tell us a little more about how you were when you came to this.
Well, I'm a journalist who's interested in the near future, and I'm also a lifelong New Yorker, which meant that I spent most of my life, you know, I was concerned about climate change. I knew it was an important issue, but I was deluded in the sense that I felt I lived in an urban fortress outside of nature in the modern world, and that while there were people elsewhere on the planet who were going to be really in harm's way from some of these impacts, that I wasn't going to be one of them, and probably most of the people I loved weren't going to be among them. And as a result, I thought, you know, this is an important issue, but it's not an all-encompassing, all-governing issue. The deeper I got into the research, just as a journalist, the more I realized it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And every aspect of life, even those that we take so eternally for granted as permanent features of the world, are subject to the forces of nature. So when I walk down the street on the concrete street, I look up at steel buildings, I'm still living in nature. And especially if you're on the coast, you're vulnerable from sea level. But really, that's just the start. You know, projections estimate that if we don't change course on global warming, we could have a global GDP that's 30% smaller than it would be without climate change. That's an impact that's twice as big as the Great Depression, and it would be permanent. We could have twice as much war as we have today because there's a relationship between temperature and conflict. Our agricultural yields could be only half as bountiful, and we'd be using that half as much food to feed 50% more people. There are public health issues. There's a relationship between temperature and mental illness. There's an effect on cognitive performance. Really, everywhere you look, wildfires, extreme weather, hurricanes, droughts, heat waves, every aspect of life as we know it on this planet is changing already. The planet is already hotter than it's ever been in all of human history, and it will surely change more, which means that everything we know about human life and human civilization grew up under conditions that no longer preside, and we're living in a different enough environment. It may even be better to think already that we're living on a different planet, and given where we're headed, things are going to change even faster, even more dramatically in the decades ahead.
Okay, well, see, and your book reads that way, unrelenting, line after line after line, just shorn, you know, sharp fact about what the preponderance of science says is to come, and quickly, because right at the beginning, you bust a lot of myths. You know, there's a thinking that, well, climate change has started around the Industrial Revolution when we started spoiling nature. But no, you say it started around the same time as Seinfeld, and more than half of the carbon exhaled into the atmosphere by burning carbon fuels has been emitted in the last 3 decades. So since sort of Al Gore and the word ecology and all of that stuff became part of our language, it's worse.
Yeah, it's really amazing to think I'm 36 years old, which means my life contains this whole story. I have memories that are more than 30 years old. I remember driving and flying more than 30 years ago. And since I formed those memories, we've done more damage to the climate than in all of the centuries, all of the millennia before in human history. That's a really dispiriting fact to know in terms of how powerful knowledge is, because this is the same period of time since the UN established its IPCC climate change body and really advertised to all of the leaders of the world that this was a pressing, dramatic problem. But if those 30 years have brought us from a stable climate to the brink of catastrophe, which is where we are now, we have about that much time again to avert some of these worst scenarios.
30 years.
Which means 30 years ahead of us. And that means really again, it's not just the story of the first half of that story that's going to take place in my lifetime. It's the second half, too. This is a drama of a scale that really we only used to understand or recognize in mythology or theology. The main driver of the future climate of the planet is what we do, and all of us are protagonists in that story and will determine what kind of future not just our children live in, but our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. That is how consequential the decades ahead of us will be.
You quote ecological theorist Timothy Morton, who calls this idea of global warming a hyper-object. It's just too big for us to grasp. We put it into sort of metaphorical terms. There are people who are out-and-out deniers. But putting that aside, you know, what should we do? And you seem to be agreeing with Steven Pinker that while making your own personal changes about whether or not you're going to drink out of a plastic bottle or take an airplane flight, you know, that's all well and good. You're not against people making moral choices, but that's hardly going to make a dent in 30 years. What is needed instead?
My short answer is political change producing policy change. We need such dramatic interventions in every sector of our world, from our energy, to our transportation, to our infrastructure, our agriculture. Absolutely every aspect of modern life has a carbon footprint, and we need to not just reduce those carbon footprints, we need to eliminate them entirely.
But in 30 years, in 30 years.
Yeah, I think most scientists would say we need to zero out on carbon globally by about 2050 in order to have a chance of stabilizing the planet below this threshold of a catastrophe. I think it's unlikely that we do that, but that's not a reason for slowing down now. I think it's really important to understand that this is not a binary system. It's not a matter of whether we pass that threshold or not. It's not a matter of whether we reach a hellish climate scenario or not. Every tick upward of temperature produces more suffering, more pain, and every tick that we can avoid will make the world a better place in the future. So while I think it's unrealistic that we entirely zero out on carbon by 2050, I think we should marshal as many resources as we possibly can to achieve that goal. And for me, that means policy action, because the truth is you and I could fly less, we could eat less red meat. That could have some very trivial impact on the global emissions pie. But if we're really trying to, say, zero out on carbon from flying, that will require an entirely different kind of jet running on an entirely different kind of fuel. And that will require significant research and development, and also probably legislation and regulation that will require it. The story of climate change is so big that we can't solve it through small actions. We need a big policy response.
Well, that's disconcerting because at least in the current administration, there's, you know, been a move away from that. But of course, people can choose to think about it going into the 2020 elections. But meantime, talking about some of those policy changes, you say, you know, farmers have to be made to feed their cattle seaweed to cut down on methane. You mentioned concrete, walking down the street on concrete. If concrete were a country, you say it's what, the third emitter of emissions? That's how much it holds on to. So it seems like you're saying come up with a replacement for cement.
Yeah, I think we need to solve all of those problems, and those problems are really everywhere. But truly everywhere you look in the world, every time you turn on the light, every time you get into a car, every time you turn on the television, every time you sit down to dinner, you're imposing some kind of carbon cost on the future. And unfortunately, as I said earlier, in order to really stabilize the climate, we can't just reduce those carbon emissions. We need to eliminate them entirely. We're at a global atmospheric carbon concentration right now of about 411 or 412 parts per million. Scientists believe anything above 350 parts per million is dangerous, and we're adding to that concentration every year. We need to actually work in the other direction and take carbon out of the atmosphere, which is really complicated and probably quite expensive, and we haven't yet begun to even undertake that project either.
Well, Evelyn, you talk about how maybe there's already technology being talked about, sucking carbon out of the air and sequestering it in the ground. Maybe there's technology that will be invented, you know, that might save humanity. Maybe humanity will evolve so that it's less human, so that there's more of a technological aspect to ourselves that helps us survive. But then we really are not on the planet the way we were.
Well, I think that we will be on a different planet no matter what path we choose, which is to say, even if we take quite dramatic action and really transform our trajectory on climate change, which is possible, everything is within our control, everything is up to us, it's not outside of our power. But even if we do that, we will be left with a world that is dramatically shaped by climate change, because it will mean huge new plantations of solar panel plants. It will mean plantations of carbon capture technology, which suck carbon out of the atmosphere. It will mean an entirely new infrastructure. It will mean new kinds of airplanes, new kinds of public transportation. It'll mean a new approach to diet and agriculture. Absolutely everything needs to be transformed and will be transformed either by the force of climate change or by the force that we put into avoiding climate change. Now, thankfully, there's still time to imagine a world that is made prosperous and fulfilling and just through climate action.
That's David Wallace Wells. He's someone who didn't think much about climate change. As he said, his new gripping page-turner is Uninhabitable Earth, the scientific thinking about climate change tomorrow. What are some of the effects? David's detail is incredible.
The thing that scares me most in a kind of reflexive animal way is the effect of climate change and temperature rise on our bodies. Temperature affects cognitive performance. It affects emotional well-being and mood. It affects the rates of autism and ADHD in developing children. The number of days that a baby spends in the womb over 90 degrees can be seen on its lifetime earnings.
More with David Wallace Wells tomorrow, here and now.